for our guests, let me explain, and this is the only church where this explanation has to take place, that I'm beginning with a biblical quote. But I don't do that every week. I do that maybe once, twice a year. So I don't want you to get scared. And for the regular people, the same thing. Proverbs says that the scornful set fire to the city, while the wise turn away from wrath. I think there's a lot of truth to that. I live at the crossroads, the dangerous crossroads, of religion and politics, where passion and current events collide, and there are often victims when these things happen. Writing several political and social columns, teaching current events, teaching comparative religion, I see what's going on in this wonderful and beautiful world, and there are times when I just want to weep. I want to weep for what it is that we do to each other, what we do to the world. I want to weep because there is so much that is wonderful, so much that is beautiful, so much that should be inspirational, and human beings end up missing the large picture for the small entities and passions. It's not our fault. That's how we got here. If you believe in Darwinian evolution, well, if you don't, I wonder what you're doing here, but if you believe in Darwinian evolution, we are the winners. We're the people that climbed out of the primordial seas, across the pampas of Africa, into the trees, out of the trees, across the deserts. We fought to survive, to mate, to flourish, and we carry within us all of that DNA, all of that history, all of that us and them stuff. I look at this beautiful, wonderful world, and this last week and the week before, when I determined the sermon title, what stimulated it was watching what South Africans were doing to the refugees who had come across their borders, trying to escape the ferocity of what was happening to them in their native lands. And of course, we look at Africa and say, well, black and black, what's wrong with them? Why are they killing each other? And we don't understand the tribal nature of white people. We see tribal nature of white people as somehow different. Yugoslavia is not tribal. Of course it's tribal. Of course the European wars have been tribal. When we are looking at tribe, we're looking at religion, at ethnicity, at what we call race, at nationality, at nationalism, and all of the reasons and the excuses that bring up those animal passions of us and them. I look at Africa, and I have relatives there, and I just wept. I had friends who had served in Peace Corps in Africa, friends who had served in USAID and in the Diplomatic Corps, and they look back at their countries and they don't understand. I have been in Yugoslavia and seen the same thing. I don't understand. I have been all over the world and I see that there are ancient enmities that can be resolved. They seem important at the time. People are willing to kill over the difference between crossing themselves with two fingers or three fingers, apparently. They were willing to kill in the beginning of the church over whether Jesus was the same substance as God or a really, really, really similar substance of God. There are people who are apparently willing to kill in the Muslim world, whether they pray with their hands down or their hands up. Stylistic differences between the Sunni and Shia. It's almost never about what the presenting problem seems to be. It's almost always about power. It's almost always about ourselves. It's almost always about how we make that other human being something less than a human being. When I wrote a sermon a really long time ago that ended up in my first book called The Three-Legged Camel, that was the name of the essay, it was about my experience of crossing the Sahara on a desert. I was on a camel that I was sure had three legs because it was galumping and bouncing and hurting and grinding, and I'm watching everybody else's camel, and they're just ships of the desert. They're just gliding across that perfectly. Their camels had shock absorbers, had air conditioning, had AM, FM radios. They had great camels, and I had a camel with three legs, all of differing lengths. So after the agony of that first day, I traded camels. About 15 minutes after resuming the journey, I noticed that my camel legs had evened out and it had grown a fourth leg, and my new camel that only the day before had four legs somehow now had three legs and was hopping, skipping, dancing, and doing a foxtrot. And I belabored that into both a sermon and an article, and somebody in my congregation came up to me and said, well, you know, that's completely normal, because let's face it, we all judge each other by what the other person shows on the outside, but we judge ourselves by what's on the inside. It's so easy to see the inhumanity in others and assume the humanity in ourselves, both of which are true. It is harder and less instinctual to understand the inhumanity in ourselves and to see the humanity in the other. That's how human beings put burning tires over other human beings and call it a necklace. That's how we use words that diminish the humanity of the other. There are keys to understanding what is calling forth from that primitive DNA of us and them. There are well-known ways in which we diminish the other. We marginalize the other. We dehumanize the other so that we can do whatever we want to do to the other. And while most of the time people think about this as in just religion is the problem, it can be politics, it can be culture, it can be ethnicity, it can be anything that we choose, and it might seem to be intrinsically important today, but it doesn't necessarily remain so. The good news is it can disappear. The less good news is it can lie dormant. And the even less good news, really the bad news, is it can be reawakened and summoned forth by the bugles of war that call us back to ancient enmities. And that's what we see all over the world. In Europe, in Latin America, and here. What particularly disturbs me as I look at the violence all across the world between different sectarian groups and ethnicities and political parties, what particularly disturbs me in watching the Democratic conference yesterday is how easy it is to get into the name-calling, and that's the key. That's the sign. That's the early warning system. Attend to how people use metaphors. They're important. They're very important. I get, because of the columns that I write, both for the Fullerton Observer and the ink columns in the Daily News and the blog column on the Daily News blog, I get a lot of email. And a lot of that email is really disgustingly hateful. It is not that they disagree with my politics. That's fine. Disagree with my politics. I'm as wrong as frequently as anybody else. But what happens is the name calling. talk about immigration. That's a legitimate topic, but those are people coming across our border. They are not rats. They are not vermin. They are not something subhuman. They are not dogs. So interesting, when I look at how we attack people of other races and ethnicities. If they are not white, we use animal metaphors. They're animalistic. They're just uncontrollable seething passions. They're dirty as pigs. They're as vile as dogs. They are rats. They are vermin. And that lets us exterminate them. But we don't say exterminate them because that would be too straight. We ethnically cleanse because cleansing is a good thing. We turn the worst vices into linguistic virtues by changing genocide into cleansing. That is not acceptable. That is not acceptable. And that's what we do. We see it in the Middle Eastern dialogue, and there's no national exceptionalism to it. It is not a case that, oh, the slaughter in Darfur is about those Muslims. Well, the slaughter in Darfur is about Muslims and tribes, but it's about people. Because Christians slaughtered Christians pretty enthusiastically, and Christians slaughtered Muslims pretty enthusiastically, and various ethnicities turn on each other pretty enthusiastically. And the thing is, we have a choice. The instincts are there. The call of the bugle and the rage are all there. But we have a choice. One of the things that we have evolved is conscience. Another thing is choice and responsibility. When I look at my heroines and my heroes, they are not saints who do not feel the rage and do not hear the bugle. They are saints who stand back and say, I'm not going to arise and follow that bugle. They are Florence Nightingale, born in wealth and disgusted by how the poor were treated. And against all family advice, became a nurse. It was an act of politics, an act of gender freedom, and an act of compassion. It was not that she did not feel the rage. It was that she channeled it into healing. She had a very strong relationship with the Minister of War, and she decided that she did not like war, and she trained a whole cadre of nurses in order to help and to heal. She channeled the rage and the pain into something constructive. When I think of Gandhi, I don't believe that he stood by objectively and detached when he saw his people being oppressed and killed. Much of his biography, and many of the biographies I have read of him, indicate that he had all of the drives and all of the instincts and all of the outrage of every other normal person. But he stepped back and said, I'm not going to do what the ancient DNA calls on me to do. I'm going to do something different. When I look at Martin Luther King, I don't see somebody who was objective, who was unfeeling, who handled everything with great equanimity. You could hear the rage in his voice. You could feel the pain in his eyes. You knew the connection and the compassion and all of those things, but he felt what everyone else feels, but made the moral choice to step back from the brink and to say no to those calls that we human beings all hear. We can't change our DNA in the next hour or the next decade or the next century, probably not even the next millennium. We will hear the beat of the drums. We will hear the call. We will understand at some level the terrible feral nature under the all too thin veneer of civilization, and we can still choose life. We can still choose generosity. We can still choose to step away from that brink and to understand that not all of our instincts are moral, and our adversaries don't have to be our enemies, and our enemies don't have to be animals, and we can step back. Left out a paragraph. I talked about how we talk about people who are non-white in this country, how we talk about immigrants who are brown or Asian or black, how we talk about people in other countries, and we use those vermin metaphors. It's interesting that the metaphors we tend to use around white people are not the animal metaphors. They are metaphors that attack the religion of the other, the ambition of the other — our enemies are megalomaniacs — the sanity of the other — they're crazy — and the sexuality of the other — they're perverts. Neither one of these categories, the ones that we use on white people or non-white people, neither one is okay. They're people, and we're people. And we need, in order to create a sense of our common humanity, to understand the genetic implications and potential of our common inhumanity. If we deny it, then we make everybody else who is mad the crazy one. We have to understand it in ourselves, too. There's no exception for Americans, for Christians, for Jews, for Unitarians. We are all the same species with the same tremendous potential. We have this remarkable technology, which, like our brains, we can use to help or to hurt, to hold and heal. And the choice is every day ours, to have the wisdom to turn away from the wrath that is a natural part of what we have carried with us from the beginning of our time as pre-humans.